Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And I know what everyone has been thinking, especially following the episode we did about slug reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
When is the episode on vomit coming? Because I know I wanted to vomit during the research for that one. And so this episode is about vomit, but not just about the human vomit, because that's kind of boring. It's about what happens when you look beyond human vomit and when you re-examine regurgitation
from a
larger
merits.
And its many merits from a larger biological viewpoint. We're going to look at regurgitation the way God looks at regurgitation, is what I'm saying.
All right, so let's get into regurgitation. But before we look at the animal world for some wonderful examples of it, I can't help but to look at us as humans here and the ways in which we regurgitate and why we do it. You know, certainly it helps when we have eaten something that's rancid and our stomach needs to get rid of it as soon as possible.
Because that's ultimately the main reason the humans vomit, is because there's something that we ingested and we need to get out. And it's a good thing to have. Not all animals can do this. Some animals, they eat something bad, it's just kind of, it's in there. You know, they're going to have to roll with it. But with humans, we eat something that's noxious and potentially dangerous. We can vomit it back up and then reevaluate it. And like many animals, eat it again if it deserves re-eating.
If it deserves re-eating.
Yeah.
Like, well, that meatloaf was so good. And now
ask your dog about this one, and I'm sure they'll explain.
All right. So
but we hate doing it, is the thing. Most of us hate doing it.
Yeah.
And in many cases, I mean, I can think of a few times in my life where I really needed to vomit, and a good bout of vomiting would have really been beneficial to my well-being.
Open up to us. Tell us when, why.
I don't remember the day. I didn't mark it on the calendar. But, you know, maybe you're a little under the weather, or you ingested something you shouldn't have that night before,
mm-hmm.
and then you're ill. And you don't want to vomit because it is a stressful experience. It's like
mm-hmm.
it kind of blows you up. You're suddenly just rattling. Your body's rattling, and you're high energy, and it's an unpleasant experience
mm-hmm.
for this stuff to come out of your mouth, and it tastes bad. I mean, everyone I think has probably vomited just listening to this podcast. If you haven't, I would love to hear why that is the case. But everyone has vomited. You know it's unpleasant, and a lot of times we avoid doing it even when we should.
Well, you know what? If you ever need to vomit, I'm just here to tell you that I will hold your hair back for you if you
okay.
need it.
Well, thank you.
Sure. But here's something I will never do. I will never pre-masticate something for you.
Oh, well, good.
Okay, so when I'm talking about pre-mastication here, what am I talking about? I'm talking about chewing up food, coating it with my lovely saliva, and then
mm-hmm.
depositing it into probably an infant's mouth, because
right.
that's generally how it's been done with humans.
Yeah, birds do it, as we'll discuss. Mice have also been observed to do this. And it makes sense for humans to do it. And granted, this is not food that has been swallowed and then properly, like, regurgitated from the gut.
Yeah, there's no bile in it.
Right. But it has been chewed up. And think of what baby food is. What is baby food but pre-chewed food? You just want a robot to chew it instead of a human.
Yeah, and it seems kind of gross, but really, I mean, this has been done since time immemorial, right? I mean, if you didn't have a blender, pre-blender days, you didn't have a grinder, this is what you did. And it actually makes sense because saliva is enzyme-rich, and this helps to break down food. And it also contains antibodies, which might coat food proteins, making them less allergenic. And this is really important because I just read a really interesting article in The New Yorker. It's called The Peanut Puzzle, and it looks at the extreme uptick in peanut allergies in kids and allergies in general in children. And some of the idea is that in undeveloped countries, you see far less instances of food allergies in kids, and it may be because of this pre-mastication with infants. So if you've got a six-month-old, they're being exposed to some of these more allergenic foods, but they're coated so it doesn't really take effect in their bodies.
Wow, that's a really fascinating idea. I mean, that really kind of blew my mind a bit because I guess I wasn't really familiar with the longstanding traditions of chewing food for a human child.
Mm-hmm.
Though, of course, I've seen footage of it. You know, now that I think about it, I've seen, like, clips of a mother in Africa, like, chewing a bit on something and then giving that food to the kid. You know, not a straight-up you know, bird mouth kind of situation. Because I think that's the vision that we think of when mm-hmm. we instantly hear about this. We think of one bird, you know, just retching into another bird's mouth. And I've seen it played for laughs, for disgusting laughs, on an episode of Saturday Night Live once, where somebody's food was being chewed for them and spit into another person's mouth. And, you know, everyone just loses it because, oh, it's so gross. But as you explained, I mean, it's part of our biological heritage.
Yeah, it's just probably not something that you're going to see in America, like, you know, in shopping malls, mothers pre-masticating food and then spitting it into the children's mouth, unless you are Alicia Silverstone, right? Because this happened last year. She was caught on video doing this with her child.
Oh, and they made a big to-do out of it.
People freaked out. But, you know, there are merits to doing this.
Yeah, well, they freak out over breastfeeding. I think it was either Covington, Georgia or Conyers, Georgia, somewhere out there just outside of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
A woman was breastfeeding a child at one of the bigger chain restaurants. I forget which, and I probably shouldn't say it if I did remember, but somebody called the police.
What, I mean, which is insane.
Yes.
That is an armed breast.
Yeah. So
that is going to get you.
What if she had been, if she'd been chewing her food for the kid? I mean, goodness knows, that would have been just instant police call right there.
Well, what I'd like to think is that some people would be so horrified that they'd begin puking, and then other people would begin puking.
Ah, sympathetic vomiting.
Sympathetic vomiting, yes. Okay, so we've seen, you know, the regurgitation in humans, and then, of course, when we overeat, overconsume, or we eat something rancid, we vomit.
Mm-hmm.
But what about people who vomit for their art?
Ah, yes, the professional regurgitator, the mm-hmm. Performance vomiter. We've briefly mentioned what were they called? The performance
flatulence.
The flatulence. The flatuists. Or
The flatuists. The flatulence artists.
Yeah, because you would have this in the old circus environment. People were getting up there and they're using their skill to the entertainment of everyone. Everyone finds farting hilarious in the right circumstances and to varying degrees. And then likewise, like I said, vomiting is gross. And it's shocking, and like everything that is gross and shocking, it has a tendency to elicit laughter.
Well, Millie Brown is the regurgitation artist in question here, and she has one piece that she's done. She's done several, apparently, but this one...
Oh, this is a contemporary artist.
I'm
not familiar with her. I'm more familiar with the older, the old photos of
Carney
regurgitators.
No, I mean, she does it up. I mean, it's pretty much performance artist type work, although she does use a canvas. So let me just explain this video to you really quickly, because we really don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but it is kind of interesting. She has basically these glasses of different colored liquids. It's a rainbow of colors.
Mm-hmm.
And so she takes yellow, she drinks it, she lets it settle, and then she regurgitates that onto the canvas, onto a white canvas. Now, you think that's, you know, odd. She also has two opera singers in the background clad in all white. And they are singing my favorite aria, by the way, Do Me Pa. And it's, you know, this beautiful opera song and this aria. And then, of course, she's regurgitating onto the canvas.
Well, this video is definitely going to go up on the blog post that accompanies this episode. So,
I mean, you know what? I appreciated it because she did put some thought into the colors she used. It is a rainbow of colors. It's not just brown vomit on a canvas.
Yeah. I mean, that's thoughtful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Add some color to it. Because the color makes all the difference. I found that when I recolored an image of a slug, it repulsed me less. So I can see where colorful vomit would have the same effect.
Yeah. You guys don't know this, but Robert is still kind of working through these issues with slugs and finding ways to deal with them. Because you've been posting on slugs a lot. And so
yeah.
And having to deal with the imagery.
And it helped a little bit, I think. I do respect them more as organisms, especially after I read some I did a post about the question, do slugs trip on psilocybin when they eat psilocybin mushrooms? And I found all this. I didn't find really a definitive answer on that, but I ended up finding some really cool stuff about slug intelligence. And there's mm-hmm. some arguments that say that their cognitive abilities are really not that far off from like a rat or a pigeon. So
we don't know for sure whether or not they can hallucinate, but if you look at their cognitive abilities,
yeah, they're
a lot
smarter than I gave them credit for, and I'm not sure just how that makes me feel better or if it makes me feel worse.
over the world, Robert Lamb.
Yeah. But back to vomit, back to mm-hmm. the issue at hand.
All right, let's look at some instances of regurgitation in the insect world.
Yes, the insect world and the world of arachnids offer some excellent examples. For instance, spiders, arachnids, regurgitate this enzyme-rich bath of caustic goo. They either regurgitate it onto their prey, and this is in cases where they sort of shred the meat a little. They shred it up a little bit, and then they vomit onto it, and the enzymes break it down. Or they regurgitate into their prey. For instance, the widow spider and many crab spiders force these enzymes, force this vomit into a hole that they make in the prey, and then they suck it all back out like a Slurpee. So they apply the grotesque caustic chemical, let it break down and turn everything into this this meat smoothie, and then they slurp all of it back up.
Yeah, and it's really brilliant the way that they do this because they get this bolus going. A bolus is basically a ball of insects. And then, you know, they've got to get all the crunchy parts down because they can't spend a lot of energy trying to break this down. So they are vomiting on it and essentially making it a protein shake for themselves and slurping it back up. But it is a very, I think it's a very cool process.
Yeah, they're kind of using, it's a form of external digestion. And you see the same thing with the housefly, of course. And a lot of people are going to be familiar with this from David Cronenberg's adaptation of The Fly, which is, of course, a marvelous R-rated horror film that manages to disgust on a visceral level but also gets you thinking and has, you know, various cultural overtones as well. One of my favorite films. But one of the traits that the scientist Brundle, played by
Jeff Goldblum,
to fantastic effect. One of the traits he gets from the fly is this feeding ability to vomit forth these enzymes onto something he wants to eat. I think he does it onto like some Twinkies for this video that he's making for his employers or his kind of his diary. Vomits onto the Twinkies, lets it sort of set for a second, and then sucks it all back up.
Okay, so when we describe to you what the housefly does, I want you to just keep his image in your brain. Like, put Jeff Goldblum's face on this housefly that we talk about.
Yes.
Okay, because consider the housefly. It's flying around your house, in your kitchen, driving you nuts. It lands on a piece of food, maybe a little morsel of sugar, and it's got to break it down. So it scrubs the dry food substance with the bristles on the end of its proboscis, its nose. This frees up the food particles.
Shreds it up, yeah.
And then the second step is a little bit like when you add hot water to instant oatmeal, only instead of hot water, the housefly adds a mixture of its saliva and digestive juices. Sounds delicious. And that's when it vomits the saliva and digestive material onto its meal. And a few seconds pass for it all to break down, and then Jeff Goldblum sucks it all back up.
Yeah, I mean, it's the shredding and the is key here, too, because, I mean, think of like when you make a smoothie in the morning. You want like small bits. You know, you add a protein powder, not a protein chunk. So
that's right, because unless your blade is like a super blade, right?
Yeah.
You can really break that down. So then the fly, if it can't adequately break down food enough for it to pass through a tube that leads into its stomach, the fly sends its food down a different tube to an inner sac called the crop. And then the fly may pass the bubble dissolving food multiple times between the crop and the mouth, back and forth, regularly applying fresh saliva. So eventually all of that gets liquefied.
Yeah. It's delightful. I mean, it's disgusting from a human point of view, but it makes perfect sense for these creatures because they're not going to you look at an animal that's not going to be able to necessarily, you know, chew its food up. It needs to do these things externally in the same way that we've externalized a lot of our eating processes through cooking. Fly can't cook.
Yeah.
Fly can't use a kitchen. So fly is going to depend on its time-honored method of external digestion.
You know, there's a part in Charlotte's Web when Wilbur the pig meets Charlotte, and he's completely disgusted by seeing her knock out her prey and is judging her. And it's really funny because she has this whole exchange with him, like, well, you are so, you know, living in the rarefied airs over there with your food brought to you. I have to work for my food, and I'm genetically programmed to do this. So
that's awesome. I had either I'd forgotten about that, or maybe I haven't read Charlotte's Web, and I've only seen the movie. And maybe that didn't make it into the movie. I don't remember.
It was a nice little exchange. I liked it. My daughter's reading it right now, so I'm knee deep in it. All right, so should we take a break here and then get to more vomit afterwards?
All right, we're back. discussing regurgitation. We just talked about our friends the fly, our friend the spider, the way Charlotte and Brendel take care of their lunches. So now we're going to talk about a few other animals of note.
In particular, we're going to talk about the proboscis monkey. Now, the proboscis meaning nose.
Right. This is the guy with the big nose.
Yeah, you've probably seen these monkeys before. They, of course, use regurgitation.
Yeah, and it's interesting because their use of their upchuck, which they do sort of a cud chewing kind of a thing. They they vomit it back up into their mouth, they re-chew it around a little bit, and then they swallow it. For most like gorillas, humans, other primates, if this is done on a semi-regular basis, it's considered pathological. It's not natural, and it's potentially harmful because you're just not you don't have the plumbing to really handle that much caustic stuff moving around all the time.
Yeah, I mean, think about us humans; the enamel will just wear off of our teeth if we were always vomiting.
Exactly, but researchers found. And this is from a paper that appeared in the Royal Society of Biology Letters. They found that the digestive tract of this particular monkey is drastically different from that of humans and great apes. So what you have when you look inside the proboscis monkey's mouth, you find a distinct chambered forestomach where bacterial digestion occurs prior to the glandular stomach. So you end up having more of this, really more what you end up thinking about in terms of the digestion system of a cow.
What I really like about this study is how it was conducted. The scientists were actually in a boat, and they were on the Kinabatangan River in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're sitting there watching these monkeys from a distance during the early morning, the late afternoon, for 3 months vomiting. And they concentrated on 23 different monkeys that were videotaped regurgitating and re-chewing. And then when this happened, the monkey's abdomen would contract and the primate would stick its tongue outside its pursed mouth. Which I think it just, that's got to be one of those points in your job where you're kind of like, okay, I'm on a boat watching regurgitating proboscis monkeys.
Yeah, I mean, they already look kind of like Jimmy Durante anyway. So they're already amusing to watch. And then they have this peculiar way of going about their meal.
Yeah, just vomiting on the banks of the river.
So this brings us around to my favorite vomiting animal, really, at the moment, because a lot of this is new to me, is the vulture, the turkey vulture.
Well, they're kind of like the ninjas, the experts at vomiting.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating. We have an article on HowStuffWorks about it, and you should definitely check that out if you're into this as a topic. But let's set the stage. The turkey vulture, if you're not familiar, is, of course, a scavenger. Haunts the skies, wheeling around in big circles, looking for some dead prey to go feast on. They find a carcass, and then it's on. It's time for the meal. Land and just start tearing apart this rancid thing and eating it. So what do you need in order to live your life on a diet of rancid flesh?
Well, first of all, you don't want a lot of feathers around your face getting all mucked up, right?
Yeah, you need it kind of like surgically
smooth.
Clean up there. Yeah.
Second of all, you probably want some like grade A stomach acid.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, think of if you're like me, say I'm not really used to eating certain types of like junk food, I guess, and probably not used to eating a lot of meat. But so if I'm in a situation where I end up really eating more than I should and really chowing down on just too much red meat, I start feeling a little ill. Like my stomach cannot handle it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the cast iron stomach that some people have, and the vulture really does in a sense have a cast iron stomach. I mean, this animal has evolved to thrive on rancid meat that would just sicken and maybe even kill another animal. I mean, they've actually shown that the enzymes in the vulture's gut are capable of handling some pretty horrible pathogens, because they have to be, because that's the nature of what they eat.
You were talking about anthrax too, right? They have found spores of anthrax in their feces.
Yeah.
The evidence that it passed through. Their gut, their acids are so effective that they can break down some of these viruses.
I mean, it's their
bacteria.
Diet. In the same way that a javelina can poop the prickly pear pins right out without any problem. I mean, the same way the vulture can poop out these anthrax spores that would be problematic to another creature.
Kristen Conger, one of the co-hosts for Stuff Mom Never Told You, has an article about vultures. And in it, she says, in a study on white-back vultures, the pH levels in their stomachs were between a 1 and a 2. That measurement is comparable to gastric and hydrochloric acid from the human stomach and is far more corrosive than acid rain, which has a pH between 4 and 5. It was also more acidic than the stomach contents of other carnivorous birds, including herons and barn owls. And barn owls, by the way, we've talked about their pellets before.
Yes.
You know, they can't really break down the bones or the teeth of what they eat, so they have to regurgitate it into these little pellets.
Yeah.
Quite lovely. Didn't you get some for the holidays?
Oh, no, I was thinking about it. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about it at one point. And then we did a podcast where I accidentally referred to the pellets as poop. And then I heard from all the owls who were really...
And then the poop hit the fan.
Yeah, the pellets hit the fan. And the owls were rightfully upset with me over that one. But I'm hoping to please the vultures in this podcast because I think we're getting everything more or less right. So the thing about their vomiting, when a vulture does vomit, and again, as we've established, animals vomit. So the fact that a vulture vomits is not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of... There's been a fair amount of thinking about why they do it, because they'll do it when they're threatened.
Right. When they're threatened and they want to do a little bit of defensive vomiting.
Now, one thing to keep in mind, when a turkey vulture is threatened,
mm-hmm.
it's probably in a situation where it's hanging around this dead body. It's hanging around this body, eating and eating and eating.
It's gorged. It's gorged. Really heavy.
Yeah. And then suddenly some humans are poking around, or maybe it's a lion. Maybe it's some other birds. It's an eagle. Something else is suddenly intruding on them,
mm-hmm.
and it's an issue. So... what does the vulture do? The vulture vomits. Now, there are a few different interpretations to take here. One of them is that it's a purely defensive measure. They have all this awful stuff in their gut, all
mm-hmm.
of this rancid meat and caustic enzymes. Somebody's messing with you, spit up hawk of that stuff at them and see how they take it. You know, don't make me vomit acid on you. That's kind of the proposition here.
That's still on my bumper sticker on my car, by the
way.
Oh,
yeah? Yeah. Don't make me vomit acid.
Another idea is that it empties the stomach chamber so they can take off.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they're just weighed down with all that nasty carrion.
Yeah,
because
they've been gorging themselves. You know, meals may be few and far between for a vulture. So when it's available, they eat and eat and eat. And if you got to take off in a hurry, you may have to lighten the load. So that's another theory. But the third theory is the grossest and really the most magnificent.
Okay.
And that is the situation where, all right, I'm a buzzard. I'm just stuffing myself in all this meat. And so suddenly there's this like this eagle showing up or there's a coyote or something getting a little too close to my business. And I'm a bird, so I know that other animals may want to eat me. I'm a prey animal to many.
Mm-hmm.
So what can I do to save myself? Well, sure, maybe I could spit some acid on him. All right, that might work. It's pretty vile stuff. Or I could just lighten the load and try to get away. But vultures can be kind of gawky. You know, it's not like they're able to just instantly just shoot off like a rocket.
Right.
So the theory here is that when they vomit forth this rancid mess, they're actually providing a bribe. They're saying, don't eat me. Eat this. And certainly, like, it was in one of the sources I was looking at, I believe this was on the Turkey Vulture website, the vulturesociety.homestead.com. They have a lot of cool facts about them. They pointed out that eagles eat it right up.
Mm-hmm.
Eagles presented with some vulture vomit, they'll be like, yeah, that looks great. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Maybe that's like fog waff to them. They're
yeah.
like, oh, delicacy.
Yeah, maybe so.
I'd like to imagine the turkey buzzard saying, though, like, if you keep me alive, I can regurgitate 10 meals, as many as you want. If you kill me, you only get one.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like if you know, here is something. Here, go ahead and eat this. You can eat this, or you can try and fight me to the death. And I have claws, and I have a beak, and I might not be the most fierce creature on the planet, but I'm a harder meal. Here's the easy meal. So why don't you have it? I know it's
already
gross.
Digested for you.
Yeah, already pre-digested.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a nice little peace offering. So, you know, what we have not thrown into the mix here is urine.
Oh, yeah. And
this just would not be a complete podcast talking about vultures and vomit without the urine.
Yeah, this is just like a bonus that you get to have urine in this podcast as well. And this is, you know, we talked about how you don't want feathers generally around the head because mm-hmm. it needs to sort of remain surgically clear so they can go in after some meat and get it all dirty. But, of course, they're also going to be stepping through some pretty rancid stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
So to disinfect their legs, they'll urinate down their legs. And I find that there's a certain gross but admirable economy to that.
Well, it's incredibly practical, right? Because you're getting rid of some of the lingering pathogens that you've been tromping along with. I like to think of that somewhere out there is a performance artist too that does some sort of vulture urinating canvas. I don't know.
Yes, let's hope.
I know you expect all this from a vulture, right? Because they're not very cute looking. They're sort of dastardly looking. You expect that they urinate on themselves and they vomit up piecemeals. But there are other creatures out there that have some pretty smooth moves themselves.
Yeah, and they don't necessarily look the part at first glance. For instance, the fulmar, which means foul gull, because it essentially looks like a seagull, and it's one of these type of birds that makes its home on rocky little perches that they find on cliff sides. And if something comes and messes with them and poses a threat, they will projectile vomit at their at the intruder. And this is a straight up. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. They're projectile vomiting to cause a distress to their attacker.
You know, I kind of thought about them as the kittens of the bird world because they are white feathered and they're cute looking. I will say it.
Mm-hmm.
And you just don't expect the sort of filth that comes projectile vomiting from their mouth.
Yeah, it's orange. It stinks of rotten fish. And it's like really oily and sticky. Like it doesn't come off all that easy. Like for a human, if you're climbing up there checking out birds and you get vomited on, you're going to have to go home and really shower and scrub to get it off.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a bird and you're messing with a fulmar, then you've got this awful stuff on your feathers, and it can actually interfere with your ability to fly. So not only annoying, but potentially lethal weapon in that regard.
And if you were a bird and you were covered this, then you should take to the water. The gut oil of the fulmar chick causes the birds to lose their buoyancy and they drown. So it's kind of like death vomit.
Yeah, death vomit. Orange death vomit from the foul gulls.
That look like kitten birds.
Yeah. Now, speaking of kittens, though, we should bring it back around, though, to humans. And our expectations of vomit versus animal expectations, and even children, because as adult humans, we end up with this idea that vomit is to be avoided at all costs. Then you invite a dog into your house, and the mm-hmm. dog is vomiting and then eating its own vomit, or you bring in a cat, which just goes off like a time bomb all the time. Just vomit becomes a part of your daily life, and then if you have a child, then even more so. They're just constantly vomiting.
It's true.
Yeah.
I've been vomited on in spectacular ways, I have to say.
Yeah, my mom is a kindergarten teacher, and I once mentioned it to her about children vomiting because we had my nephew vomited in the back of the car when we were taking them somewhere. And it just happened all of a sudden. The other one, the niece, she was complaining of stomach problems.
Mm-hmm.
But then he vomited, and it was a huge mess. And I mentioned to my mom, she's like, oh, yeah, kids those age, like kindergarten age kids, first grade, they just vomit all the time. They'll just be doing something. They'll be coloring and then just vomit.
It's true, and they just keep going. They just pop a breath mint and keep going.
Yeah. And then eventually they get a little older, and they begin to believe this lie that vomiting isn't a part of who we are.
And boy, are they wrong.
So there you have it, vomit. We would love to hear your stories on vomit if you have things that you would like to share with us. Your encounters with vomit in the alien kingdom, preferably, not just that time that you upchucked and it was spectacular, but just sort of telling stories of vomit. Animals that you've seen that seem to be engaging in regurgitation in a unique or fashionable way. Let us know about it. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Tumblr. We are Stuff to Blow Your Mind on both of those. And on Twitter, we go by the handle Blow the Mind.
And you can always drop us a line at blowthemind@discovery.com. For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.